Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. This week, that film is 1969's The Magic Christian. This is the film that added a time pressure to the Beatles' Let It Be sessions, arguably at a time when they didn't need any more pressures, and possibly even contributed to the Beatles breaking up. Is this film responsible for the breakup of the Beatles? Who's to say? More importantly, is what we got from the film worth it? Let's find out. So the actual initial synopsis for the film is: the world's richest man and his adopted hobo son set out to test the limits of human vanity and greed through a series of money games, in quotation marks. I'm going to say straight off the bat, I didn't immediately get that that's what the film was about.
Yep.
It feels less like a plot and more like a loose framework by which there are some sketches that are broadly in the same area. Is that what you found?
Yes, I think that's very fair. So when you call it like a series of sort of money tricks on people, that's exactly what it is. It is a series of things, a series of sketches, essentially. It basically the same structure as something like Kentucky Fried Movie, where... you know, probably a formative influence on Kentucky Fried Movie, but yes, essentially it's a lot of sketches strung together. You could be forgiven for sort of reading the synopsis and only then realizing what the whole thing was about. That is broadly what happened to me. I had an idea of what was going on, but I don't think that idea was made terribly clear in general.
It doesn't help, I think, that at the start of the movie, I don't know if you found this, but the it feels like there is a lot of setting up that the film does that you can't hear because it's playing a song over the top of what's quite a lengthy montage where Peter Sellers, the rich man, meets Ringo Starr, the hobo, young guy, and adopts him as his son. And there's conversations between them where it feels like this would be important to listen to.
Yes.
But you can't hear a word of it.
Yeah.
You can just make out some fragments of what they're saying.
Yeah.
And it feels like there's a mix somewhere in that film where the music's actually turned down and actually what you listen to them is actually really important to the setting up of what's about to happen for the rest of the movie.
Yes. This is exactly what I thought. To the extent that I wondered whether it was a mistake in the mixing, in the sound editing, and that maybe, you know, I needed to get on the phone to Talking Pictures and demand my subscription money back. Not that I've paid them any subscription money, but anyway, I think that is a very, very strange editorial choice.
Yeah.
So at the start, Peter Sellers, he gets out of bed. He's obviously very rich. His chauffeur drives him off somewhere. And he walks into what I think is St. James's Park in London.
Right.
And Ringo is standing on a bridge feeding the ducks. You hear him going up and saying something about feeding the ducks, are you? And then the music gets steadily louder until you can't hear at all what they're saying.
Mm.
And what they're saying is the entire, not quite the entire premise, but the setup of why Ringo's character is in the film at all.
Yeah.
That Peter Sellers wants to pay him to adopt him legally as his son so that he can help him out with all these tasks. And he then sort of goes to a business meeting and seems to sign a contract whereby Ringo is now his son. So the first time you really hear them talk to each other without that music is where Peter Sellers says, right, that's it, or something.
Yes.
And Ringo says, father. And
yes.
And then you broadly get what's just happened, but they've made you work for it.
Yeah. And at that point, I think we're like 12 minutes into the movie.
Right. Yeah.
But you then also don't get, one, necessarily why that's happened.
Yeah.
Why Peter Sellers' character is interested in adopting Ringo Starr in the first place.
Yeah.
Presumably he has some kind of scheme in mind. I guess you feel that way the first time upon watching it, but I don't think that's true. But you also don't understand what their next plans are, what the next steps are, and that kind of ends up coming about later on as the film progresses.
Yeah.
It does feel to me, sort of as an initial reaction to the movie, it did remind me immediately of Magical Mystery Tour, possibly because that was the only other film in a similar kind of style that I'd seen recently, having not seen many sketch-based, raunchy, early 70s sex comedies.
Have you not?
not this year. It feels like it reminded me a lot of that film. It obviously is one of those films that is clearly so very much what you might say of its time, but also the kind of film that doesn't get made at all these days, and probably for good reason.
Yes.
And I guess, you know, we're looking at this retrospectively now, and watching the film and trying to, you know, pick it apart and appreciate it and I guess point out its merits and its flaws. It's quite difficult to do that in a film where it feels like the entire movie is just designed to be subversive and surreal, in a particular way.
Yeah, and so it's subversive. I'm sure it was very subversive for its time, and I think, in fairness, it is fairly subversive viewed through today's lens. I think one of the interesting things about it is that this must be set. This is set within a context of 1960s sort of countercultural art, more broadly than just cinema, that seemed an awful lot of that, including a lot of music, including a lot of the work of the Beatles themselves, seemed to have as its primary function the discarding of form and structure. Whereas, I mean, the Beatles obviously knew structure quite instinctively, worked within it. So even something like Revolution 9, I always think has a sort of pretty readable pop song structure in a way, and I think they will have influenced a lot of music, and cinema influences may have come from somewhere else, but they do seem to have this theme of sort of throwing away structure completely as a subversive tactic, you know.
Yeah.
So but Magical Mystery Tour certainly does that, and you know, sort of Paul talks about how that sort of influenced people like Spielberg. Whether Magical Mystery Tour was a direct influence on the Magic Christian, I don't know, but I think formally it kind of throws everything out of the window, and when it just ends very abruptly.
Yes, you know? Yeah, of course. And I think the one of the issues with that is that I think it's a film like this is quite hard for a modern audience to appreciate outside of just an academic view. I think I think there are some moments in the film that are genuinely brilliant and very, very, very funny.
Yeah.
But on the whole, it's more a curio. Like it becomes a it becomes a bit of a time capsule type of movie because it doesn't really seem like it has a place now for modern audiences to enjoy it as a film, as audiences would have been expected to do so in 1969 when it was released.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, you look upon it as a sort of cultural artifact more than
yes. A
film you actually necessarily want to sit down and watch.
Yes,
and
yeah,
derive
yeah.
enjoyment from, I suppose. Yeah.
On the basis that this is a film that is a series of long sketches, what do you think worked better than others?
I think there are bits where so there is a sort of broadly anti-capitalist theme to the whole thing. The idea is a little like Trading Places, I suppose.
Yeah, that was a film that came to mind when I was watching this. Trading Places and can't remember the other one. No.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Trading Places, even to the extent that there's a guy in a gorilla costume, like quite late on, you know.
Yes, right. Yeah. Brewster's Millions, that was the one I was thinking of.
Yeah, of course.
There's sort of like, so 80s movies that are also about a, you know, sort of, I guess, how to do funny things with lots and lots of money.
Yeah, sort of rich men playing tricks on poorer people for their own amusement because they can afford to throw money away.
Yeah.
I think there are things that are sort of quite subversive insofar as sort of the actor Lawrence Harvey, who is on stage playing Hamlet, and he has been, you're not particularly told this, you kind of have to figure this out for yourself, but he has been bribed by Guy Grand, Peter Sellers, to do a strip tease in the middle of the Be or Not to Be speech.
Yeah.
But bits like that don't particularly make me think of an anti-capitalist thing, because essentially you haven't actually seen the money change hands.
It hasn't really been
made clear to you that money has changed hands at all.
And also that is, by the way, I wanted to mention this, I thought that sketch was absolutely hilarious. There is a moment in that scene where he, having already started to do quite a slow striptease whilst delivering like a Hamlet's delivery, he just does like a very quick jaunty leg movement, which just cracks me up because it's just this sort of weird flirtatious like moment that he does. And I thought that was hilarious. And I thought there is a possibly even funnier than him doing that. There's a moment shortly afterwards where Peter Sellers completely deadpan tells his guests that he's with that fellow is taking license, in my view.
Exactly, which is the line I like.
It's so funny.
So
it as a sketch that works really well, but what ends up confusing the premise, because you're right, I think we're expected to believe that at some point Guy Grand bribed him to do this. What confuses that premise is that he then gets carried on upstairs, which light up, and then there's a big Zap production sign that comes into view.
Yes.
And that doesn't come from a bribe. So, like, what exactly were the inner workings of this deal?
Yeah.
Like, it's not, he didn't just bribe the actor, presumably he bribed the whole production, and it just becomes a bit confused.
Yeah, and I thought the same with the music, because there's that sort of standard striptease music that's going on.
Yeah,
and I wasn't
sure
whether it was contiguous or non-contiguous. So, like,
is
there an actual orchestra playing this? Has he bribed the entire orchestra, or is this music just being superimposed? And I suppose things like that. It's very easy to be picky about things like that, but it does take you out of the premise.
Yeah,
and a film like Magic Christian, which is trying to make a point, There's lots and lots of opportunities or places where it almost encourages you to forget what that point is.
Yeah.
Just through some, but again, it's that lack of structure that does that.
Yeah.
That probably has that effect overall.
I mean, we should talk, I mean, while we're on the subject, we should talk about how the climax of the movie is, and I feel like this is a little bit more clear cut, in that Peter Sellers and Ringo Starr, Guy Grand and Young Man Grand, they have clearly co-opted the launch of a new ship, the Magic Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And the maiden voyage of this ship is seen as the social event to be at. So the creme de la creme, the A-list celebrity stars, social elites will be the only people who will be on this ship on its maiden voyage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clearer, I think, that there is a scheme at play.
Mm.
That Guy Grand and Young Man Grand are planning something with those passengers. What ends up happening is chaos.
Yeah.
and not even chaos that sticks to the premise that has been set up so far, but like, you know, if most of the other sketches have been pushing ideas or challenging ideas and concepts around money and what people would do for money, there are moments with the passengers on the ship where you just have, for example, Christopher Lee being a vampire, which has nothing to do with money.
No, yeah.
And there's nothing to do with anything that is explained that something that Guy Grand or Young and Grand might have set up.
Yeah.
It builds up into sort of just more utter total chaos. Where there's lots of fast edits and, you know, there's a guy in a gorilla costume running around and like the monsters and that kind of stuff. And I feel like at that point the film has lost its way, but I also feel like it's not uncommon for a film that of its genre to do that.
Yes, true. Yeah, I think it certainly at that point, if it hadn't already, you know, sort of half an hour before, has got to the point where it is just throwing everything against the wall. I mean, yes. What goes on that boat is I mean, the whole thing, as I say, doesn't really have any narrative structure, but at that point it just descends into madness. You know, Roman Polanski is sitting at a bar. And by the way, seeing as it's supposed to be a boat full of celebrities, maybe they are essentially playing themselves, I don't know. So yeah, Roman Polanski's sitting at a bar, a drag act starts singing to him, who turns out to be Yul Brynner.
Yeah.
And he's singing Mad About the Boy to him, which contains a line saying, I'm not a schoolgirl in the flush of my first affair, which must have been a big disappointment to Roman Polanski, I'm sure. What's the other one? I think there's like two bodybuilders.
Yeah.
So there's a guy who's sort of overtly racist in something he says, and then there's a black and a white bodybuilder. And I think, do they swap heads or something like that?
I don't know if it's them that's swapping heads, but you're right. There is a scene where on the ship there is they go and witness like an operation, and it is the idea is that it is the first interracial head transplant.
Right, okay, yeah.
And it's been botched because the camera does this very funny thing where you see a black man's head, and then over the sheet you see the feet pointing the wrong way at the bottom.
Yeah.
So it's a botched interracial head swap.
Right.
Are there any other sort of moments in the film that you feel like you particularly enjoyed or didn't?
I think there are the boat race one I quite enjoyed. I thought there was, because there was some sort of there was some staging in that. There was a bit of spectacle. Guy Grand bribes either the Oxford or Cambridge. It's
Oxford, he bribes. Yeah.
Oxford, he bribes to throw the boat race, but to actually like ram the other boat amidships and smash it in half. Graham Chapman, who at one point he and John Cleese did a pass on the script, I think. So he and John Cleese are in it. So Graham Chapman is sort of the leader of that Oxford boat team. It's quite nice to see him in general. So this was 69. I think Monty Python's Flying Circus was first on TV in 69, so they would not have been terribly well known.
I think this was, I could be wrong, I need to check my timelines. I thought that this was pre Monty Python's Flying Circus.
I think it is, yeah. They might have been known from sort of other TV things.
But yeah, I think they're on board as writers. I think they contributed sketches to the script and then presumably as a result of their work on it ended up being in the film.
Yeah.
The scene that I was going to say that I particularly enjoyed was the auction scene at Sotheby's with John Cleese, because yeah. I think he is brilliant in that. He really makes that scene come alive. So it is a Rembrandt for sale, and Guy Grand, rather than let it go to auction, essentially, well, he doesn't bribe the John Cleese auctioneer character, but he basically says that he will pay over twice the amount that it's expected to go for. And then, having made that agreement, proceeds to cut the nose out of the portrait, and says, "Keep that," and then burn the rest. But it's John Cleese's like shocked face, and then he also has that brilliant moment where he says, like 30, I think it's £30,000 that Guy Grand's willing to pay for it, and he like stutters over £30,000, and then says, "Shit."
yeah, that's right.
And then there's a real like, there's a real cut immediately after that. But yeah, John Cleese is particularly brilliant in that scene, and dare I say, arguably sort of steals that scene, I think, from Peter Sellers, who is otherwise doing a very good job throughout the whole film in being a funny character.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to go back to John Cleese, I think John Cleese has always been expert at playing slightly stuck-up establishment figures who have their bubble pricked in some way. He's excellent in that. And in Monty Python sketches, he's always playing that character. He's always playing a sergeant major or a head teacher, or you know, the person who you like to see get their comeuppance in some way. But I think sort of going back to Peter Sellers, this film is all his, really. He's sort of in charge of all the scenes. He is the one making everything happen. So there's the one in the restaurant. It's this very expensive restaurant. He goes in and he orders whatever food he has.
It's caviar,
duck à l'orange, and then he gets them to put a sort of big tarpaulin on him, and then he just with his hands slams the whole thing into his face and he eats it that way. Again, it's like, in terms of the point being made about everyone's got a price is sort of the point that he's trying to make, and I suppose the point the film's trying to make. I don't know. I mean, that's where I fall down. I know what point that character is trying to make, but what the film is taking from that, is it sort of money is bad? You know, there's a big sign on a wall right near the end saying "Smash Capitalism." But I don't particularly feel like the film is anarchic. Certainly, it's anarchic in that, like John Cleese, the John Cleese character, the straight society is being disrupted by weirdos. You know, and there's a lot of that. That's a big theme of sort of 60s counterculture in general. Right from the sort of, well, I mean, right from Elvis in the 50s, you know, and up until, I mean, the Beatles themselves certainly did that, you know. Rolling Stones came along, they were even more shocking, you know. But when you get into the sort of mid 60s, you know, the psychedelic period, if you want to call it that, you know, this idea that people are growing their hair long and they're not wearing ties anymore, and which is a really big deal at the time. You know, that's the thing. It's really hard to appreciate now how big a deal it was now. But I mean, just the idea of anyone just sort of getting up and sort of shouting in a theatre or something like that. You know, it's just so far away from what British society in particular was like at that time. And what they're doing time and again in these sketches is going into a place where there is an established orthodoxy, a sort of fairly posh middle class one, and disrupting it, and not that that is a point it's making, because it's more of a theme than it is a sort of narrative, I suppose.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah,
and I think that when you say that you know what the character's plan is, what his motivation is in the film, I feel like we only know that because there is a synopsis that explains that. But actually, it doesn't necessarily ring true in the movie because, like you say, the restaurant scene is a good example of the synopsis implies that Guy Grand is testing people's limits for their own price. Like, you know, how to what extent everyone is corruptible, and to what extent, to what price does it take for them to corrupt their core beliefs?
Yeah.
But actually, the restaurant scene is something that where that doesn't really get challenged. And actually, what is being challenged there is, I guess, societal etiquette. But I think ultimately, probably doesn't need to be read too much into because it's just played for laughs.
Yeah.
Right. Like that, someone has written that. You know, someone has approached that sketch with what would be funny for someone to do. They had a limitless amount of money.
Yeah.
And this is what they came up with. Yeah. And it's broadly tied into this idea of anti-capitalism, but it's not really.
Yeah. And actually, I would be very interested to know which bits Chapman and Cleese wrote. That restaurant sketch, for me, kind of has their fingerprints all over it. It's the same thing as Mr. Creosote.
Exactly,
right?
That's what I was going to say, very similar.
And, you know, it is someone who has been allowed into a very posh restaurant because they themselves are very posh and very respectable and behaving very, very badly when they get there.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing. And, I mean, that is a pretty constant theme through lots and lots of Monty Python
material, of course,
in general, I think.
So, moving away from Peter Sellers, this is Ringo Starr's first major starring role in the movie. So I think I'm right in thinking that in the Beatles films, he was generally deemed to be the better actor of the Fab Four.
Yeah.
So do you think this was his real first test as an actor, sort of breaking away from the Beatles and him going it alone to sort of see whether or not acting was an actual feasible career for him?
Yeah, it's an interesting way to frame that question, because I wonder whether he was thinking at that time about, is acting a career I want to pursue?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there's the thing, you see that kind of footage in, I think it's about 67, it's certainly they've all got Sergeant Pepper moustaches, and they're all kind of turning up at Abbey Road and being in, because they just stopped touring. And although they haven't particularly told anyone that they've stopped touring, and they haven't done anything or been seen for quite a few months, and so the reporters are saying, you know, what are you doing with your time now? And John, Paul, and George are all saying, well, you know, we could sort of writing songs, and like George has been to India and stuff like that. And Ringo just says, well, I'm kind of out of it that way. I don't really have a sort of creative outlet.
Yes.
And I think he says, well, yeah, there may be a film next year if we do one together. But he doesn't seem to be considering a career beyond the Beatles necessarily. But I wonder if 1969 is a slightly different spin on that as far as he's concerned. So chronologically, we're just at the point where, you know, if you've watched the documentary Get Back, what is now being filmed in the Magic Christian is happening about 2 or 3 weeks later.
Yeah, which is crazy, isn't it, putting that in context in that way.
Yeah, exactly. But so I suppose previously, when we all thought that the Let It Be sessions were terrible and they were all splitting up and they hated each other, then we might have thought Ringo is now thinking, I really want to get into this film thing because the Beatles are not going to last very long. Now, you know, we know that context a bit better after Get Back. They were already having conversations about the next album. He probably thought, well, this is the thing I can go away and do. I quite like doing films. He and Peter Sellers became really good friends, I think.
They're
sort of on the set, I think. I don't think they knew each other particularly well before that.
Sure.
I'm not sure whether he was thinking about it in career terms.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
He had another acting role before this, didn't he? What was that in?
It's 1968. There's a film called Candy he was in, which you would broadly... I have not seen, but from... I watched the trailer this afternoon, and you would broadly describe it as a... I don't know about sex comedy.
Well, just not a, one of those.
Just a, yeah.
Just I don't know if he had range, but he knew what he liked.
Yeah, quite right. Which he seems to be in... playing a Mexican or Spanish gardener, complete with accent and and complete with tan. So I think it's of its time, it's fair to say.
Okay, but another, hey, another film that we have to caveat with of its time. Oh, good. Yeah.
But hey, you know, neither of us has seen it. Who knows? You know,
I'm sure we'll get around to it eventually on one of these episodes. So he was, so he'd already appeared in that film. Do you think if this was some kind of test for him, and to see how well he could stand on his own 2 feet as an actor outside of the Fab Four, how well do you think he fared? What do you think his performance, how do you rate his performance in the film?
I think it's good. I think it's hard to judge without seeing it through the prism of that's Ringo Starr, and I like Ringo Starr.
The thing
that is a real problem for him right off the bat is that his character has no narrative reason to exist.
Yeah, it's quite a challenge for any character, isn't it? Yeah,
exactly. Because I think so. Apparently. It's based on a book from 1959, and
yes,
and sorry, I forget the guy's name who wrote it. Maybe it was Terry Cousins, maybe, or something like that, who wrote the book. But he co-wrote the screenplay, and apparently the character of Youngman Grand did not exist in the book.
That's right. Yes, as I understand as well. Yeah,
it was about it was just about the Guy Grand character going around doing this stuff. And so when you look at it, there's no reason that Guy Grand needs anyone with him to do any of this, because he's very rich. He doesn't need... There's even less reason for him to adopt anyone legally as his son in order to do it. There may be... There are things where he's sort of introduced in business meetings as, you know, this is my son, and I think it's, you know, the idea that he'll be taking over from him. I'm not sure that's what he said. But that doesn't seem to have anything to do with anything else. Ringo's character, like I say, there isn't any reason for him to be there. And I suppose what happens... just from a screenwriting point of view, is when you have a character who doesn't need to exist, you probably end up giving them throwaway lines, and I get the impression that Sellers was a bit of a scene stealer as well.
Yeah.
So he gets eclipsed quite a lot. I think he has funny lines, and they're well delivered. You can't really ask any more of him than that, because he's given a lot to do. You
know? I think there's a couple of things there. That I think that first of all, the author's name is Terry Southern, which I'm not picking you up on that in a mean way. Yeah. I've just googled it whilst you were talking.
Right, but Terry Cousins pretty close.
To be fair, yeah, there's a few consonants out of place, but you're pretty good. And it's also interesting to note that it's based on a comic novel that came out, I think, roughly 10 years before. Peter Sellers gave it to Stanley Kubrick as a gift, and Stanley Kubrick ended up hiring to co-write, I believe, Doctor Strangelove. Just as a random aside there about the history of the author of that book. But I think that there's quite a lot of trivia around the film, which has to be said isn't necessarily verified. I don't know where some, you know, like IMDb trivia, I don't know where it comes from. Like, there who has interpreted like four generations worth of information to arrive at a pithy trivia note, but there's quite a lot about how Peter Sellers was quite dominating in the film. So one of the trivia tidbits is that he deliberately had John Cleese's role downplayed so that because he was worried that he might upstage him in that in that scene that he's in. There's also a mention, I think, in one of the trivia items that Peter Sellers would deliberately say or incorporate Ringo Starr's dialogue into his own, which is as. If you imagine that Ringo Starr might be seeing this as his big break, it's probably a little bit disheartening. But yeah, you can. I guess he's just one of those characters, isn't he? I don't know an awful lot about Peter Sellers as a person. I don't know how much of a reputation he has for being that kind of challenging actor to work with. But you can imagine that he is someone who is difficult to control on set or handle on set. So you can imagine that he... That as a newcomer to acting, that might be quite a difficult thing to contend with.
Yeah.
So on that basis, I think Ringo Starr actually does a really good job of holding his own opposite Sellers without much material to work with, because apparently, according to IMDb, it's been stolen from him. I think he holds his own. I think there are a couple of moments in the film where he actually does get his own moments, and he's brilliant in those. There's the bit where Spike Milligan's the parking ticket inspector, and the whole while he's arguing with Peter Sellers about the ticket, and Peter Sellers is basically going to bribe him to eat the ticket to get rid of it. All during that dialogue conversation, Ringo Starr is reading a book about, I think it's symmetric exercises. And he's doing, like, you know, outstretched yawn faces and tiny faces and stuff. His delivery of that is actually pretty brilliant and funny, right? That shows like a physical comedy side to him that basically isn't present in the rest of the film. It's just really good to see. I think that there's almost more that could have been made of that side of that character, of him doing stuff like that's just quite funny in the background.
Yeah, certainly. I suppose the interesting thing is that you've got a beetle in your film, lads.
Yeah,
like, you know, still pretty popular at the time, you know,
and
still doing all right now in terms of popularity. You know, like, you would have thought that I don't mean that they would rewrite the entire thing to get him in. Apparently, the role was written with John Lennon in mind,
right? Okay,
and I don't know whether it got as far as him being asked to do it and turning it down. Certainly Ringo ended up doing it,
but it was always seen as a Beatle vehicle of some kind. Or a vehicle for one of the Beatles of some kind, perhaps.
I suppose so. It has enough Beatle elements in it that it sort of suggests that, doesn't it?
And we were talking before we start recording this that the director, who I'm going to look up again because I've forgotten his name. Joseph McGrath, thank you, yeah. Prior to making this film, had directed some of the very early music videos for the Beatles. So there is a connection there that exists before he comes to direct this movie. So I guess it does make sense in a way that it ends up becoming sort of Beatle focused in some way. And there are, we should talk about the fact that there are other elements of the Beatles that creep into this film as well. So I don't know if you noticed, but the passengers that arrive on the ship, the Magic Christian, at the time, there is a John and Yoko lookalike that board the ship. There's also, I couldn't find any reference to this anywhere online, but I'm pretty certain that when there's a big reveal after all the chaos on Magic Christian and all the passengers come basically evacuate the ship, and then they realise hilariously that they're actually they've been on a stage set the entire time, and they're actually in the middle of London. Then one passenger gets off with a life, like boat thing around him, a life jacket around him, and he sees Tower Bridge, I think it is. And he says, that's Tower Bridge. And the camera cuts to Tower Bridge, and I'm pretty sure that what plays over that is the final chord of A Day in the Life.
Oh, the big piano chord.
It's a big, like, it's a big, yes, long cynic horn, but it's also not even just they've recreated it. It sounds like it's exactly the same.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there's those couple of Beatles elements they brought into it.
Yeah.
And then obviously the big one is that Paul McCartney wrote the theme song. What's essentially a theme song for the film, Come and Get It.
Yes, yeah. And so, yeah, and I suppose the interesting thing about that is, like, its lyrics are, its lyrics have a lot to do with what happens in the film, or what the theme is of the film, you know. So Come and Get It, Come and Get It, the lyrics sound a lot like he's just sort of taking them from an advert, you know, because you hear and read a lot about Beatles in John and Paul in that period, who had just been watching something on TV and just sort of taking one line from it and building a song around it, you know. And Come and Get It, you know, it's,
yeah,
lyrics are, you know, you better hurry because it's going fast and things like that. It's exactly the kind of thing you get in a advertising slogan. Will you walk away from a fool and his money? You know, and Guy Grand being the fool with the money in that context, I suppose. So I mean,
yeah.
I suppose I don't know, but what interests me is, was McCartney given a brief, like, here is the script? So we know that he demoed this in the Abbey Road sessions,
right? Okay.
So certainly, yeah. So I suppose if you think of the timeline, I'm only just realizing this as I say it, actually. But yeah, if you think of the timeline, so the Get Back / Let It Be sessions are in January. In that, you see Dennis O'Dell saying to Ringo, well, not just saying to Ringo that the script, you know, here's the script, and Ringo says, I haven't read it. but the thing is about to begin shooting, so they must have shot the whole thing when he comes up with that song, because he demos it in, I think, about August. He gets into Abbey Road a bit earlier than everyone else during the Abbey Road sessions, and he demos it, piano, bass, drums, and a vocal track.
So let me get that straight. So do you think he's written that before then it becomes a commission for this movie?
Yeah, so he must have, well, the movie, I guess, if it begins shooting in February, has probably already been shot by August.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
And in fact, when is it? Yeah, so we know that he demos this song during the Abbey Road sessions. I think it was in August. So the film, I'm presuming, if it started shooting in February 69, has been shot by August.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, you presume that he knows the theme of the film, or maybe, yeah, has even seen a rough cut of it.
Yeah.
So, but what I don't know is whether someone said to him, can you write us a song for this film? Here's the theme of it. And therefore, he writes those lyrics deliberately.
So there was a thing that I read. I don't know where I read this. It might have been the Wikipedia page for the song, because that's the extent of my research on these things, let's be honest.
Sure, sure.
There was something that I read that said that he'd written the song about the last throes of Apple, the Apple business that he set up with the Beatles, and, right, and the sort of the failures of that. But it feels like, I mean, he could be drawing on both, right? Mm. There's a song that is required that is clearly about money being thrown about, and actually there's a history that he could, you know, that sort of informs a similar kind of scenario. So you can imagine that he's drawing on, or he could be drawing on both there. Probably more likely that he's doing that than he has written a song about a fool parting ways with money, and it just so happens that one of his bandmates is going to be in a film that is about the same thing.
Yeah,
but I'm really intrigued to know how he became involved in the project. I think that's a really interesting sort of area that there doesn't need to be a lot of information about. Like, at what point did, whilst Ringo having signed up to star in a film, at what point was Paul McCartney approached, or in a room where the idea came up that actually maybe he could contribute a song to it, and then he just went ahead and wrote a song, demoed a song, and then auditioned the band essentially to then perform that song for him, on the movie soundtrack.
Yeah, so I think essentially what happened. I mean, so one other thing about those lyrical themes is that they're there. in You Never Give Me Your Money as well, which he is writing around the same time, I guess.
And the one thing I was going to point out was that I don't know if it's because of that, the similarity to that song in terms of themes, or because of the way that the piano is played in the song in Come and Get It.
Yeah.
But when I first heard it, I felt like it definitely would have had a place in the Abbey Road medley. It feels like it fits in really well with the style of those songs that they run through.
Yeah, no, you're right. I never thought of that. That makes a lot of sense. I think... so Come and Get It, it's a song that Paul writes and demos quite quickly. It feels to me a slightly half-finished song in a way. Yes. I think its melody is great. It's essentially one lyrical refrain that repeats. It's got no second verse. In the second verse, some of its lyrics are make your mind up fast. And there is a bit, you know,
classic Get Out. Right. Finished the song.
But
you know for a fact he was on a deadline. He was like, you know what?
I've got that
second verse sorted.
Yeah. But yeah, and there's a bit where it, you know, the sort of will you walk away from a fool and his money, it sort of turns into like Fool and His Money, where he just sings Fool and His Money.
Yeah.
As, you know, it seems kind of half finished. Anyway, but what he does is he demos it, and he gets an acetate of that demo, and the band Badfinger, who were a Welsh band who were signed to Apple Records, he takes it to them and says, record it exactly like this and it'll be a hit.
Yes.
Because he knows a thing or two about hits, you know. And I think it doesn't change very much from his demo, which you can hear on the anthology, and I think maybe the Abbey Road Deluxe 50th anniversary.
Oh, is it on that as well? It's on Anthology 3, but yeah, you're probably right. It's probably on the Abbey Road Deluxe as well.
So they've added some harmonies and stuff, and oddly as well, the way that Badfinger singer sings it sounds quite a lot like John Lennon.
Do you think?
I think, yeah. But I think there may be something about sort of vocal treatments that people were doing at that time, Lennon included, that made people's voices sound right. Quite similar. I'm not completely sure.
He was always quite funny about his voice, wasn't he, John Lennon? Like, he was always doing stuff to it, and he had a bit of a complex, I think, about his voice. So
yeah,
you're probably right. I'm sure I've read somewhere along the way that some of the tricks that were pulled in the studio in order for him to sort of sound or make his voice sound different ended up becoming sort of, you know, tried and tested techniques that are then put then used throughout sort of recording songs going forward.
Yeah absolutely.
It sounds about right.
Yeah.
I never got the impression for the song that he sounded like John Lennon, actually. I think maybe because to me, as soon as it started, it sounded to me like a Paul McCartney song. So I should point out that when I first watched the film and that song came on, I got really confused because I recognised it as a Beatles song. I recognised it as a song that I knew really well.
Yeah.
So I assumed it was a Beatles song because I was watching a Ringo Starr movie, but I just couldn't place the song.
Yeah.
And then Googled it, as all our research is done. and then discovered where it came from. But I'm still not sure whether or not I know the song so well because I've heard it on the Beatles records, like subsequently the Paul McCartney demos.
Yeah.
Or whether actually it is a fairly well-known song in its own right outside of, you know, the hardcore Beatles fandom. Considering it's a Peter Sellers starring vehicle, he was obviously already a massive star at the time of making this film.
Mm-hmm.
The film, I think, bombed generally, which I guess, you know, watching it now is understandable.
Yeah.
or no wasn't surprise, well received, right? So, yeah. Wasn't well received, right? But for the case that Ringo Starr had a lead role in it, and that Paul McCartney wrote a song for it, and there are, you know, those other cover elements of the Beatles being introduced into that film, it feels like it should be more remembered among sort of Beatles community or Beatles fan community or whatever. It should feels like it should be have a higher profile than it does.
Yeah.
But it has kind of just been forgotten about, I think.
Yeah, and I think there are films the Beatles went off and filmed that are sort of better known in the context of their career. We now have a bit more context about Magic Christian because it is the reason why they had to complete the Let It Be sessions in 30 days or whenever it was. But for years we didn't, I suppose. So films like How I Won the War, people know, because it's where John Lennon shot it in Spain, and he wrote Strawberry Fields there. And so, you know,
is that why that film's remembered though? I feel like it's that has a higher profile among sort of the context, the wider context of the Beatles. I guess because it's seen as John Lennon's first major acting role. Like he digressed from the path of being a Beatle for a short stint in order to try out being an actor and then came back again. And I feel like that's sort of an important milestone among thousands of milestones in the Beatles' career.
Yeah.
Whereas this Ringo Starr essentially doing the same thing, albeit right at the very tail end of the Beatles, just kind of has been largely forgotten.
Yeah, yeah. And while it is probably fair to say that How I Won the War it has been no more or less widely seen than The Magic Christian.
No, yeah, you're right.
I just think I think it's something that just people are more aware of. Probably
is it more credible? Like, is it maybe because it was better received? I don't know if it was without looking it up, but like I kind of have a view that rightly or wrongly that the film, I guess, yeah, has a bit of more of a credible standing, whereas Magic Christian, I guess, is probably been dismissed over time as a surreal, irreverent sex raunchy comedy thing. We keep coming back to the sex comedy.
There isn't that much.
There isn't much. I don't know why we keep talking about
sex, Matt.
It's not me. But there are elements of that in there, right? There's an entire scene where they discover the hull of the ship, where you have is it Jane Fonda cracking the whip of
it's Raquel Welch, of course.
Cracking the whip of hundreds of topless women who are all supposed to be rowing the boat.
Yeah.
Which is made even more pointless when it later becomes a reveal minutes later that it's not even a real ship.
It isn't even being rowed.
No. What were they even doing there? But there are scenes in the film where there's sort of gratuitous female nudity.
Yeah.
So I guess it kind of falls slightly within that genre of sort of sex comedy status.
Yeah. Well justified. Yeah.
Thank you.
It's not us.
Definitely not. But yeah, I think maybe that's one of the reasons why it's been largely forgotten. It's because it is seen as a little bit more trashy, a little bit less like it has like it's an important part of cinema history, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. And I suppose, with How I Won the War, because that was in 1966 when they just stopped touring and they all sort of went off and did other things. George went to India for the first time.
Yeah.
Paul went off to France and then Kenya and stuff like that. They did a lot of travelling and stuff. And that was what John did. He went out to Spain and sort of... And I suppose it is maybe associated as a milestone a bit more.
Yes.
Because... that was the point at which they all kind of started to diverge, have kind of slightly more individual personalities and interests and stuff like that.
There's a broader context there.
Yeah,
but we can dig into that when we have a future episode discussing famous sex comedy, How I Won the War. Anything more to add on Magic Christian, or should we wrap up?
No, let's wrap it up.
I think that's right. So if you've enjoyed listening to us, then please hit like, subscribe to our podcast, write a review, do all the other things that podcasters normally say at this juncture. You can also follow us on social media accounts, normally at Beatles Films Pod, I think, on all the usual platforms. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.
Thanks, bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.